Los Angeles health officials have closed a parody coffee shop called Dumb Starbucks for operating without a permit. Dumb Starbucks. Nathan Fielder, who has a Comedy Central show, Nathan for You, is responsible for the idea. It looks a lot like any Starbucks location, okay, with the notable exception that the word dumb precedes just about everything. Dumb Starbucks, you order a dumb grande or a dumb venti and a dumb latte and so on and so on. And while it was open, according to the reports, it was quite the hit. We're talking Los Angeles here. Of course, this is going to go over great. USA Today reports lines of hundreds of people waiting hours to order their drinks, but the health officials shut them down. They didn't have a permit, and Starbucks, the real Starbucks, is apparently weighing how to proceed. And Nathan Fielder adds, don't misunderstand, he loves the real Starbucks. So he's on board with Starbucks, but it was a parody. I guess he just couldn't resist. Welcome back to Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. You're listening to 90.5 WKAR. With prolonged frigid temperatures, frequent snowfall, and related transportation and power emergencies, winter has hit mid-Michigan hard. And with more than another month of the season to go, Lansing and many other municipalities are lower on salt supplies than they would like. Last week, the Michigan Department of Transportation told MERS News that local and state governments are being forced to lobby the state for extra funding to continue the battle against the weather. And for a look at the impact winter has had on Ingham County and where we stand with about six more weeks of winter remaining, Current State welcomes Denise Donahue, director of the County Road Association of Michigan. Hi, Denise.
Hi, Mark. Good morning.
Good morning. And we'll also point out the director of the Ingham County Road Department, Bill Conklin, also joins us on the line. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Mark. How are you this morning? Thanks for having me.
Just fine. We're glad you could both join us. Bill Conklin, put the county situation into some perspective for us here. How much salt do you have left? How much should you have left at this point?
We have just under 3,000 tons on hand, and we've got about 3,000 tons left on our contract. So we've got about 6,000 tons left that we can access. We typically contract for 15,000 tons, and we'd like to have a little bit more on hand or left in our contract, but we have been going through it pretty heavily this season.
Are you in touch with the state like some municipalities are?
Well, we're in touch with our suppliers. We understand City of Lansing has contacted the state, and we've been working with City of Lansing on that as well. We've contacted our supplier, which is Detroit Salts, and three other suppliers, Cargill, North American, and Morton, and they're all indicating that they've got to satisfy their existing contracts first, and then they'll parcel out salt is available after that on an as-needed basis.
So are you keeping your fingers crossed the weather just is more cooperative than it has been? Is that the big piece of the puzzle as far as you're concerned?
Well, certainly we're doing that, but we're also, like we've been doing all season and that we typically do, particularly out on our rural roads, we're stretching the salt with sand, chlorinated sand. We've been using about 30% sand, but we're upping that to about 50%, especially out on our rural roads where it's not going to be inclined to clog up gutters and storm sewer systems. In the urban areas, we're not able to cut with sand as much, but we're doing what we can to stretch it out and use it judiciously.
Denise Donahue, explain what's going on a wider basis here.
Well, certainly we're hearing statewide as we travel around the state, and in fact, I am on the roads this morning. There are agencies, the county road agencies, are using more sand. They're beginning, as Bill just described, beginning to cut the salt with some sand to try to make it go further. So motorists are certainly seeing more sand on the road. It's obviously not the optimum solution, but we've been hit hard, and so we really need to stretch what we have. I think one of the untold stories, and I'll be interested to hear Bill's comments on this, is really the equipment. One of the side effects of having such reduced funding for roads over the last decade has been the wear and tear on the equipment. And as I travel around the state, I'm hearing people talk about fleets that are averaging 12 and 16 years old, when in fact our road agencies would like to keep them closer to 8 or 9 years old as an average across the fleet. So you think about these trucks, it's not just like you're in my car, Mark, driving us to work, but it is trucks that are on the road working hard, scraping, pushing, you know, lots of snow and ice for 12, 16 hours a day. It's been a real difficult year. I think the maintenance of the fleet, while it's very tied to the roads, but it's an untold story that we don't think about.
Bill, what kind of shape is the Ingham County Road Department fleet in?
Old and frequently needing repair. Denise is correct on that. The average age of our equipment is about 14 years. Our trucks are getting upwards of 200,000 miles. Now, in car years, that would pretty much be retired, but trucks do last a little bit longer. We have some expert mechanics on our staff that do an excellent job of fabricating repairs and keeping them on the road, but yeah, definitely it's a symptom of lack of road funding, that the equipment's kind of aging out. Some of our specialty equipment, our ditch digging equipment and paver and so forth, are also pretty old.
How closely are you watching this the debate at the state capitol then, Bill?
Well, I've kept an eye on it for quite a long time. Actually, you know, half dozen or 10 years or so, it's kind of been going on a while. This year, you know, well, we get kind of excited every year and then nothing happens. You know, we are keeping a close eye on it. There's a lot of activity, but that's been sort of the case for the last 4 or 5 years that I've been watching it. Certainly the state budget surplus helped to what they're now calling the, I think it's called the Road and Risk Reserve Fund. It's extra state revenue that they're doling out to road projects. That's a big help. Ingham County picked up some funding on that. For Michigan Avenue over in the west side of town there in Lansing Township.
Have you ever run out of salt before, Bill?
There was a winter a couple of years ago. I think, I want to say it was 2010-11 winter that we ran a little low towards the end of the season, but we never really ran out. It was just kind of like this year where it was getting near the end of our contract and deliveries were getting a little few and far between. What folks should understand is the world isn't running out of salt. The upper Midwest, Great Lakes Basin, sits on years and years and years worth of salt supply from upstate New York to northern Ohio and into the Detroit area. It's the bringing it up, processing it, stockpiling it, and delivering it out to the road agencies that falls a little bit behind. What they do is they take contracts from all the road agencies. They stockpile enormous stockpiles of it and plan their mining activities and stockpiling activities to satisfy their contracts. Once that planned availability of material is low or depleted, becomes a matter of how quickly can they get it up from underneath the ground and deliver it out.
Denise, is the system that Bill Conklin describes, could that use some refinements, or what's your take on that larger approach?
I think what I was going to talk about is a bigger picture. Running out of money is probably a little more scary than, you know, as Bill described, we sit on a great deposit of salt here, but folks, what we, you know, may not understand is that their road agency budget, most folks, it's a calendar year, so it begins in January. So folks are using up what we call the maintenance fund, preservation fund, and it's all one chunk of money. So I have talked to road agencies where there's been a lot of snow and particularly a lot of blowing, so they have to keep doing the roads. They're 50% through their year's maintenance budget, and we're 6 weeks into winter. And so, you know, and don't forget, we got November and December coming up yet in 2014.
This is a calendar year budget, not an October to October or October through September situation.
Most of the people I've talked to, that's the case. So Bill's absolutely right, where surplus money from the state can come for winter reasons, a reserve fund can come to the counties for taking care of winter problems. Those are band-aids on the bigger issue, which is our road agencies need bigger budgets all the way around. All we're talking about is clearing the snow. When all the folks are telling me when the pothole season occurs in late March or April, the frost is very, very deep in the ground. We're going to see more potholes and chunks being tossed up onto the pavement than we've seen in a long time. And that's, you know, the underlying issue of a lot of this is, you know, not only is it a hard winter, but we need to repair these roads. And if we use up the maintenance budget simply clearing snow and spreading salt, which is very, very important to safety, we're not going to have what we need to begin to patch and repair this spring and summer.
Current state, speaking with Denise Donahue, director of the Michigan County Road Association, also Bill Conklin, I beg your pardon, Bill Conklin, director of the Ingham County Road Department. Bill, how concerned are you about just dollars in your department?
Well, yeah, like she said, all the road agencies are probably better than halfway through their winter maintenance budgets. Ours is as well. At the end of January, we were over 50% of our salt budget. We're probably 60-65% done, you know, as of this week, the last couple storms we had, adding to that. Same with overtime. We measure our winter maintenance budget in terms of salt and material usage as well as overtime. Our workers' regular time, of course, is budgeted separately in salaries. But, yeah, in terms of the overtime and salt, we're well past 50% usage of those budgets for this year, which is considering there's about five winter weather months in a calendar year, January through early April and then late November through December. We're quite ahead of where we should be, and, yeah, that's going to hurt our ability to do surface maintenance in the summer. And Denise, I also agree with Denise about the frost. We have very deep frost penetration this year, and hopefully it thaws slowly, because if it doesn't, we're going to have a very soft road surface and upper base layers with a very hard frost underneath, and that's going to make for a very wicked pothole season.
Denise Donahue, if you could have the road funding formula of your dreams, what would it look like?
Well, I think the dollar amount is where we would focus, and we met with our board last night, and I think we are thinking that the local road situation in Michigan is probably a $2.1 billion issue that needs addressing. We obviously aren't going to fix them all overnight. We didn't get here overnight. People would need to ramp up. But right now, the average motorist is probably paying about a dollar a day to drive on Michigan roads. We've seen some studies, so it's $365 a year. That includes your vehicle registration and your any kinds of gas taxes that we're paying at the pump. So that's about what's going to roads right now.
Wow.
And, you know, we had a study just a few weeks ago that was unveiled that said in the greater Lansing area, motorists on average are paying $1,000 a year in vehicle repairs, front-end alignment, new tires, detours to get around road issues. And so I think the fix is much cheaper than the problem. And we just, you know, hope the legislature and the governor get together and figure out exactly how to get that done.
Boy, you just quoted a figure, though, that is nearly $1 billion more than what Governor Snyder has asked for. And many in the legislature's jaws hit the floor when they think about 1.2, and you are proposing 2.1 is what's really necessary.
For the local roads, absolutely. Their county roads are our local roads. When you look at the state rating system, 52% of the roads are in poor condition. And I mean, that's a uniform rating system that everybody uses. Another 30-some percent are in fair condition. We only have 20% of our local roads in good condition, and our bridges are, you know, in a state of challenge as well.
Bill Conklin, when supplies and budgets are under pressure like they are, do your decisions as to when to send plows out change? In other words, Does Ingham County need to get 4 inches of snow before you send the plows out instead of 3 under normal circumstances?
No, not in terms of turning out. We, you know, safety is our highest priority. We always turn out and get the roads scraped. What it's really changing in our operations is just trying to stretch that salt out a little bit with sand. Winter maintenance is really our highest priority. It's a safety concern. We don't want to sacrifice motorist safety. So where it impacts us budget-wise from the whole year-long budget point of view is going to be in the surface maintenance in the summer. Certainly, we try to deploy winter maintenance as judiciously as possible. We try to avoid salting on very low volume roads and your 25-mile-an-hour residential roads, except for, you know, intersections, hills and curves and that type of thing. But that's always been the case in a tight budget year or not. Well, of course, they've all been tight budget years lately. But really, we don't sacrifice the safety. We still turn out and do what we've got to do to keep people moving safe.
Denise, what kind of pothole season do you anticipate?
Well, I like Bill's term, a wicked one. Sadly, I'm afraid it's going to be a wicked one.
Yeah. And you are fearing impact on projects budgeted for later in the year.
No question about that. Again, as I'm talking to our 83 county road agencies, what's being used for the winter maintenance is going to take away from spring and summer maintenance. And all we're doing there anyway, in large part, is, sealing cracks so that moisture doesn't get down there next winter, fixing potholes, really not getting down to some of the more major reconstruction, resurfacing issues that would move more of those local roads out of the poor category and into fair or good. That's the bigger step we need to take, but we're even concerned about routine cracks and pothole repair.
Well, current state will continue to keep an eye on the dialogue going on at the state capitol. For now, we want to thank Denise Donahue, director of the County Road Association of Michigan, also Bill Conklin, director of the Ingham County Road Department. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks, Mark.
Thanks for having me.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. The healthcare industry in America is a multi-billion dollar behemoth. It's a high-stakes arena where the quest for newer and better pharmaceuticals collides with government regulation and a relentless profit motive. But what's sometimes lost in the dialogue is the messaging aimed at helping the patient take charge of their own health. It's Dr. Glenn Nowak's job to convey that message. He's director of the Grady College Center for Health and Risk Communication at the University of Georgia. He was also director of media relations at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Glenn's now a senior communications consultant for the Task Force for Global Health. Dr. Nowak is speaking about health risk communication tonight here at Michigan State University as part of the College of Communication Arts and Science Brandt Lecture Series. Dr. Nowak, welcome to Michigan. Welcome to Current State.
Thank you.
Talk to us a little bit more about health risk communication. What forms would our listeners recognize as health risk communication?
Well, it comes across in a number of different ways. It's everything from the conversations you have with your physician or your healthcare provider, how they talk to you, what they talk to you about, to efforts by government agencies to educate people about things like HIV prevention, educate people about getting an influenza vaccination, to efforts by commercial companies trying to get you interested in their products, whether they're over-the-counter drugs or whether they're prescription drugs.
It's anybody who watches one of the network newscasts in the evening I think, predictably gets an awful lot of TV. So TV advertising is included in what you would call health risk communication. And how is this landscape changing?
Well, there's a lot more people trying to persuade consumers, trying to reach the public with information and advice related to health. There's a lot more people doing it through public channels like advertising and the internet. Consumers are bombarded with a lot of different places and trying to make sense of it all, trying to figure out who's trustworthy, who's credible, what advice should I take, what I should listen to is really, really difficult sometimes. And a lot of these companies and a lot of these agencies are putting the emphasis on the benefits side. They're telling you about the benefits and probably not telling you so much about the potential risks.
How has the internet changed this landscape?
Well, the internet has made it possible for a lot more people to put a lot more information out there. It's made it more difficult for consumers to judge information. So now you've got information that maybe 15, 20 years ago would have been much more difficult to find, that you can now do a search and bring up lots of information. There's a lot more competing and conflicting information. If you go back 15, 20 years ago, you probably had the advice of your healthcare provider and you probably trusted it and took it. Now when your provider gives you some advice, you probably go home and search the internet to see, are there other things that the provider hasn't mentioned or are there other points of view that weren't brought up in that conversation?
Do employees, do pharmaceutical companies have conversations with you about this topic?
When I was at CDC, I spent about 7 years as director of communications for the National Immunization Program. So I was involved at that time with a lot of immunization-related communications. And pharmaceutical companies were always interested in what the CDC was going to be saying about vaccines. They wanted to make sure that we were helping promote vaccine recommendations. And so in that instance, they weren't telling us what to say, but they were interested in what we were saying because it affected them and it affected their communications.
Is there enough skepticism on the part of the public toward health risk communications?
I think what
healthy. let's qualify that as healthy skepticism.
I think you see healthy skepticism, and I think you also see misplaced skepticism, and then there are probably areas where you could use more skepticism, and so it's fascinating to look at when you see things like with vaccines. There's probably maybe the proper amount of skepticism, and maybe some people have a little bit too much skepticism. When it comes to vitamins and supplements, you probably have not enough skepticism. And then when it comes to some of the over-the-counter drugs, you probably, again, not enough skepticism, a lot of acceptance. When a company tells you that their drugs will help you cure flu symptoms, I think a lot of people would like to think that that's true, and they're probably not going to be as skeptical as they may otherwise be.
When you were at the CDC, what was a particular challenge that you encountered or something newsworthy during your tenure there that kind of captures why you do what you do?
Well, I was the director of media relations when we had the influenza pandemic. And so I was on the front lines of trying to develop the messaging to guide people about this new form of or this new flu virus and what it could mean. And that was a tremendous challenge. And we spent, I think we did press conferences every single day for about 2 months to try to stay on top of that and to answer the public and media questions about how much should we be concerned about this new virus, what's happening in terms of being able to prevent it, what are the recommendations in terms of vaccine. So I would say that the 2009 H1N1 pandemic was one of the things that was a real challenge on the communications front.
How do you generate trust on the part of people who hear health risk communications?
I think the most important, two things that are really important. One is being transparent, being open with what you know, but also open with what you don't know, and being willing and able to acknowledge, here are the things that we don't know. I think the second thing is trying to look at the issue from the perspective of the public or the perspective of the patient and think about what kinds of questions will they have, what kinds of concerns will they have, anticipate those concerns so that you can provide answers up front. And a lot of the best communications is about setting and guiding expectations.
What about chronic American health problems and the communication that goes on there? I'm thinking of smoking and obesity primarily. Those are issues that have been messaged, if you will, for decades. How is that changing, and how is that done effectively?
Well, I think obesity is a really good example, because obesity is a very tough challenge, and it's probably an issue. If you're trying to help someone lose weight, or you're trying to help people maintain healthy weight, communications is part of that recipe, but it's not the entire recipe. And so you're going to have to be able to do other things to help them. Communications is important in terms of giving them motivation, giving them information, giving them support, but it probably at the end of the day can't be the sole thing that helps people lose weight or maintain weight. And that said, I think some exciting things are happening with new communications technologies, and people are using interactive websites. They're using iPhones and smartphones as a way of being able to help people do things like motivate themselves to get to exercise.
Well, between how much communication is changing and how much the pharmaceutical world and medicine is changing, this sounds like a really stimulating line
right.
of work to be in. Describe your work with the Task Force for Global Health, which I understand is involved with messaging about the inactivated polio vaccine.
Yeah, right now the world's been trying to eradicate the polio virus from the face of the planet. Mm-hmm. Only one other virus has been eradicated. That was smallpox. And we're very close with polio. But the last step, the last 1%, has been a particularly difficult challenge. The original goal, I think, was to wipe polio off the planet by 2000. We haven't accomplished it, and we're in 2014. But as a part of that effort, one of the things that they have to do is they have to get 124 countries across the world that are currently using the oral vaccine, and only the oral polio vaccine, to add to their childhood schedule the injectable or inactivated vaccine. And the reason for that is, if you want to get the world free of polio, you not only have to get rid of the wild or naturally occurring viruses, you have to get rid of the viruses that are related to the vaccine. The oral vaccine uses a weakened virus.
Can you share anything of what you will be addressing in your lecture tonight?
Well, I'll be talking about some of the things I've learned when I was at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in my 14 or 12 years there, in terms of working with scientists and doctors about communication, some of the lessons I learned, some of the things that aren't so obvious until you actually sit down when you're trying to get a doctor to become a better communicator. And so I'll be highlighting some of those examples. I'll also be spending a little bit of time talking about some of the lessons I learned in terms of how we can do things better and how we can be more effective as communicators.
Dr. Glenn Nowak is the director of the Grady College Center for Health and Risk Communication at the University of Georgia. He's speaking about health risk communication tonight here at MSU as part of the College of Communication Arts and Science Brandt Lecture Series. Nice to meet you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. In an effort to increase the United States' renewable energy portfolio, the wind industry has grown tremendously. Michigan is now home to just under 700 wind turbines. But not everyone is happy about wind farm projects. There have been complaints about wind turbines, including decreasing property values, noise, endangering wildlife, and an unusual disorder called shadow flicker. We'll learn more about that in a minute. Some people who reside near wind farms even claim that the turbines are making them ill. Jerry Punch is a professor emeritus in the Department of Communicative Sciences and Disorders here at MSU. As an audiologist, he's also been called upon as a witness in several disputes over wind turbines, and he's here to break down these complaints. Jerry, welcome to Current State.
Good to be here. Thank you.
How important is wind energy to the United States' overall renewable energy production? Is an awful lot of anticipation being invested in that sector?
There has been, and it is a vital, it is an important component. It surprisingly, though, at this point, wind generates about 4% of all electricity in the country. That's not a lot. And only about 1.5% of that amount is actually consumed because of storage issues. It's very expensive, given the battery technology that's currently available to store the energy. So it has to be used when it's, at the moment, it's generated, essentially. If it can't go on the grid and be used, then it's lost, essentially. So not as much has come from the wind energy movement as was expected, I think.
But we've got some technological issues to
address
here.
There are some technological issues.
People still invest an awful lot of hope in that, I suppose.
Yeah, there are about 73,000 megawatts of energy generated in the states, as of the last quarter of 2013. But basically, the wind speed has to be about 8 miles an hour for the wind turbine blades to turn. And the rated capacity is reached only when the wind is about 30 miles per hour. And there really aren't that many places in Michigan except the shores of Lake Michigan and Lake Huron, and, of course, Lake Superior that turn up that much wind. Mm-hmm. So the bottom line is that we generate electrical energy from wind at about 15% to 30% of the capacity of the wind turbines.
Okay. Now there's a lot of debate around wind energy. You've got people who are definitely advocates, and you've got those who are against it. Can you break down the major pros and cons here to wind energy?
Yeah. Everybody who's familiar with this knows that there definitely is a pro-wind movement. The energy companies, of course, are getting subsidies to produce wind energy with wind turbines. The pro-wind group, there are others too. The governments, in fact, are pro-wind, basically. You know, we all should be pro-wind in a sense that it can generate some fairly substantial amounts of energy for us.
Mm-hmm.
As I said before, it's not doing as much as we had hoped. But the pro-wind group says install as many turbines as feasible. They don't believe that health is really an issue. They have denied to this point, to this date, that health is a problem. They say there's no definitive research to show that it's harmful, that is, turbines are harmful in any way. They say what you can't hear can't hurt you, because much of the talk about health has to do, rather, with the issue of infrasound, which is sound that you really can't hear. And there's a lot of, we'll talk about that if you want in a minute. The anti-wind group says wind energy is not economically viable in the United States. In most places, there's not really a lot of wind to turn the turbines. Of course, there's exceptions, as I mentioned, around Michigan. But Michigan is not one of the states that has a great rating as far as wind potential goes. Some areas of California, Montana, Wyoming, Iowa, even the Dakotas have possibly better potential.
See, it's mostly a plain state phenomenon. I saw the list of the top five states, and we're talking Minnesota, Iowa, I believe.
Iowa's
number
at the top. Yeah.
Yeah.
Certainly, I think Iowa's the state that produces more of its energy with wind than other states, a greater percentage than other states. So the anti-wind folks, there are people who say just stop all these projects immediately because wind energy is not economically viable. I think there's a third group. I try to put myself in that group. I certainly started out with a very neutral attitude, and I've come around to putting myself in a group I would call pro-health. Rick James, a colleague of mine, came up with that term as far as I know. But this group, I would say, install turbines where they're economically viable, but only at distances from people that don't put them at risk for their health.
Mm.
And I believe that what you can't hear can hurt you, because I think there's enough evidence that, number one, wind turbines do indeed produce infrasound, and there's a lot of literature dating back to the 80s and even back to the 60s, if you go back a little further, saying that infrasound in large buildings through large equipment like heating, ventilating, and air conditioning systems produces infrasound and some health effects associated with that sound.
Are these are vibrations, then, I take it? Well, is it fair to compare infrasound with a vibration?
It is, in the sense that an intense acoustic intense acoustic energy can vibrate objects, but it is not, if you think that wind turbines are just stuck in the ground like a tuning fork and vibrate the ground, that's not true.
And how can infrasound impact health exactly? Do we know much about that?
We know that wind turbines, as I said, do produce infrasound. There's also the possibility that there's electromagnetic waves, dirty electricity, that could produce some of these effects. But most of the problems associated with reports of health have to do with infrasound, we think, because the ear can process this sound, even though we don't hear it as audible sound. It goes to the brain. There are pathways to the brain that affect other areas than the primary auditory areas of the brain that can cause sensations like ear pressure, fullness of the ear, certainly dizziness, tinnitus, just strange feelings, tingling feelings and that sort of thing. So that's why we think infrasound is really at the heart of the core of most of these complaints. Many, many of these complaints are anecdotal, but there is some hard research to suggest that it is indeed infrasound that's causing these problems.
Is what you've just described labeled wind turbine syndrome then, or is that something different?
Wind turbine syndrome was a term that Dr. Nina Pierpont, a New York pediatrician, came up with after she heard some complaints from families and started interviewing them. I believe she interviewed 38 people from 10 families, including a number of children. She found that the effects were some of the ones I mentioned. Certainly sleep disorders is a major complaint. Dizziness and tinnitus, just general sensations of tingling. People had to leave their homes in some cases because of these strange sensations. Some people have had heart palpitations. That's more severe symptoms. We're not saying, and Nina Pierpont was not saying that everybody suffers these problems, even those who live fairly close to turbines. It's a fairly small percentage of people, but it's a non-trivial percentage. And as I said, a number of people have taken the drastic measure of leaving their homes because they can't tolerate.
So there is some amount of anecdotal evidence here that is fairly compelling.
It is. Epidemiologists, and I'm not an epidemiologist, but they tell us that adverse event reporting is the first step in establishing how bad a problem is and what may be causing the problem.
Well, Michigan has, I guess, just under 700 wind turbines here. Have you heard of many of these anecdotal accounts coming from our
state? Well, my first introduction to this area was right before I retired in 2011 in Ubley, which is in Huron County, the thumbnail of the thumb of Michigan.
Okay.
I went up there with my colleague, Rick James, and we interviewed families. One family who eventually filed a lawsuit. I was not involved in that lawsuit, but they have settled with the wind company. I'm not sure what the terms of the settlement were. I'm now dealing with a family in McBain, Michigan, in Maseke County, who have the same problem. They were renovating their home, beautiful home that he, as a construction person, had built himself, about 12-year-old home. They were adding to it, and a wind turbine was put right in front of their big A-frame type front of their house, a big glass, covered area. And the wind company is saying that it's because they don't like the visual aspect of it. That's not it. We don't believe that's true. I interviewed them at length. In fact, I formulated an interview form questionnaire that indicates to me, taking them at their word, of course, and I do believe they're being very honest about their symptoms. They had to leave their home and live in a cottage some 20 miles away, and that is currently a pending lawsuit.
Do you see some? Do you see a lot of conflict in the future between the wind energy sector and the public at large here?
Well, there's a lot more happening. Yes, there has been some of that controversy, and I think it's getting worse. If you look on the internet, and again, this is where you get your anecdotal stuff, basically. Although there are a lot of newspaper articles that document these things, if you go deeper, there are court records. And there's scientific literature that sort of document all this as being factual.
Fascinating discussion. We want to thank you for coming in here today. Jerry Punch, an audiologist and professor emeritus in the Department of Communicative Sciences and Disorders here at Michigan State University. Thank you, Jerry.
Thank you very much, Mark.
This segment is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. More news about the Great Lakes environment can be found at greatlakesecho.org and on Current State every Tuesday as part of our partnership. Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Michigan, of course, has a rich organized labor history, and much has been written about the early days of the United Auto Workers Union. In Built in Detroit, a story of the UAW, a company, and a gangster, author Bob Morris looks at the union's infancy through the eyes of his father, Ken Morris, who was a regional director of the union. And he was in that position at a time when union officials faced not just resistance, but also acts of violence. He suffered a brutal beating. Bob Morris will talk about his book here in Lansing tonight. The Michigan Political History Society discussion begins at 5:30 at the AFL-CIO headquarters on South Washington Square. Bob Morris, welcome to Current State.
Thanks, Mark.
For starters, tell us about your late father.
Well, my dad came to Detroit in 1935 with nothing. He and some guys were basically looking for jobs, and they got to Detroit. All his buddies left inside of a month. He stayed and ended up going to work at the Briggs Manufacturing Corporation. That's the company in the book. And that was about the time that the UAW was getting started. He got active. And the UAW, his local union, Local 212, the Briggs local, became his family, and he began to move up in the ranks of the labor movement, getting winning more elections, moving up higher within the organization.
And how high did he?
How
rise?
High he became a UAW regional director in 1955, which meant he's on the UAW executive board, worked with Walter Reuther and saw an awful lot in terms of collective bargaining growth, social policy growth, and got involved in a lot of politics, especially here in Michigan.
There were assassination attempts against Walter Reuther and his brother. Your dad was seriously injured in a beating in 1946. Tell us more about the kinds of violence that union officials faced in the 40s.
Well, you know, in the 30s, there was the violence on the picket line as unions were getting organized. And by World War II, unions were pretty much here to stay. But there are some companies who did not want to live with that status quo. And Briggs was one of them. And they ultimately hired people from the underworld to take out strong, militant union leadership. My dad came back from World War II, was elected by acclamation to a high position, and he gets back within 6 months. He's beaten to within an inch of his life. He survives and moves on in his career. But his beating is linked with the same people who tried to assassinate Walter Reuther and Victor Reuther. Mm. And we believe they're the same people. The gangster is the man named Santo Perone, who was a kind of a maverick gangster in the Detroit area. And he was known for in some cases taking out people, and certainly for busting unions, bringing illegal immigrants into the country via Canada, and dealing with illegal booze. So Sam Perone was a infamous gangster from the 30s, 40s, 50s. In fact, he's ultimately going to get blown up at, in front of his car wash in 1964, and he still causes trouble, minus a leg. So Santa Perone was one tough guy.
How did you learn about the attack on your dad?
Well, one of the great things about my dad is he worked all the time, but on weekends he'd often take my brother and I to events. And so in time, it never came from my dad, but people would make comments about the beatings. And then at one point we saw a photograph of him, which is in the book, and, you know, it's a brutal photograph of a man with blackened eyes, fractured skulls, broken arm, and so forth. That was the result of the beating. And so we knew something terrible had happened.
We're talking with author Bob Morris. His latest book is called Built in Detroit, a story of the UAW, a company, and a gangster. Through your dad, you met and you got to know quite a few people whose names we still remember in 2014. Who were some of those?
Well, of course, there were some of the political people from Jack Kennedy I had a chance to meet, Hubert Humphrey, people like that. Probably the most significant person I met who today is still a hero in my life is Walter Reuther. Walter Reuther was, by Time magazine, picked as one of the 100 most influential Americans of the 20th century. And he's a legacy. We've kind of forgotten him. And it's too bad, because Walter Reuther was a visionary, was the first environmental speech I ever heard was by Walter Reuther in 1966. He was a strong supporter of Martin Luther King. The March on Washington was something. There were six speakers. Walter Reuther was one of them. He was a visionary when it came to collective bargaining. Many of the benefits that our middle class here in Michigan have taken for granted are ideas that came from Walter. Mm-hmm. He's a very special guy.
One of the most chilling photographs, and I believe it's in your book. I happen to see it on the website associated with your book, so it's probably in the book as well, involves Reuther and the overpass. The overpass incident, which has really become legendary, and there is one photograph of just prior to the attack starting, and both sides, the thugs on one side and Reuther and his colleagues are on the other side, and there's actually this tentative smile on a couple of their faces, but all hell is about to break loose as we remember that. There's some really stirring photographs in your book.
And
as
I can remember Walter talking about those thugs who worked for Harry Bennett of the Ford Motor Company.
Of course.
And I can hear Walter to this day talking about how he was dragged off the overpass and his head hit every one of those 48 steps going down.
I take it the gangster in the book's title is Santo Perone.
Yes.
Then describe your research for Built in Detroit. You spent a year at the Reuther Library doing research, including your father's six oral histories. How much did you learn that you didn't know before?
Oh, boy. You know, it's interesting. I learned a lot. I learned details that I didn't have before, some things he just had never talked about. And I had to be careful because sometimes the oral histories were a little bit different. The memory, you know, does different things. So I had to try to figure out what was real, what wasn't. But basically, he provided what I learned as a kid were black and white stories. He provided the color for many of those stories. And plus, there's so much additional research at the Reuther Archives, which is an incredible institution. And that was great. Doug Frazier was still alive then, former president of the UAW. His office was in that building. So I had a chance to talk with Doug a lot about what I was doing research-wise, ask him questions. And so the whole research experience was wonderful.
We're talking with Bob Morris, author of Built in Detroit, a story of the UAW, a company, and a gangster, and it focuses on his father's life rising up through the ranks of a UAW, the Briggs local in Detroit. One might assume, with your background, that your book would paint the UAW in an always favorable light. Is that basically correct, or do you explore some of the more questionable elements of the union's history?
The UAW is a great union. I'm proud to have been a part and a member right now in the National Writers Union. But like any organization, there are some, not everyone's perfect. And in fact, a UAW regional director went after a lot of good union members at Briggs. It was a political battle. And that guy ended up to have links with organized crime in Santo Peron, and eventually Walter Reuther fired him. So there are some bad guys.
How long was your dad active in union activities?
Well,
he died in 2008.
Right, and in many ways he never stopped. I mean, it was in his blood. So he was always active. He was always involved. He retired in 1983 from the UAW, the mandatory retirement age for him. And so really from 1935 almost until the day he died, I took him to a UAW convention about 3 years before he died, and his memory was gone, his legs were gone, but he was really proud to be there.
What do you make of the current state of the UAW and its relationships with the domestic car makers?
Sure. I think the UAW has done a great job, as always, and when we think about it, when a company's been in trouble, the UAW's been there, not just in this latest cycle of bankruptcy, but when Chrysler was close to going bankrupt in 1979, when the companies were, you know, put their cards on the table and were honest, the UAW will always step up and try to address the company needs. And I think more so now than ever before, the companies and the unions realize they're in the same boat together. And if the companies are fair and employ Americans, the UAW will grow and benefit from it.
Since it's on the front pages of all the Detroit papers today, I have to ask you about Mary Barra's new salary. She's getting a sizable raise from Mr. Ackerson. What do you make of that?
Well, $14 million is nice, and I know Northville, where I think she lives, and you can do very, very, very well with that. But, you know, Bill Ford, I think, makes about $10 million. I mean, one of the things we have to remember, the auto industry, as well as Wall Street, the executives are doing very, very well, but our middle class is doing about as well as it did in 1973.
Bob Morris will talk about his book, Built in Detroit, a story of the UAW, a company, and a gangster, in Lansing, 5:30 p.m. this evening at the AFL-CIO headquarters on South Washington Square. Bob, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, our Neighbors in Action segment features the Hazlitt Robotics Club, which works with youth to foster interest in STEM. That and more Wednesday on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us. It's Current State on WKAR.